Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined in the studio by Nick McKay, the CEO of Envirosent, and Robert Winborn, the founder and managing director at Brookwood Associates. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Nick, I'm going to start with you. I'm kind of fascinated to learn more about Envirosent. Could you tell us a little bit about the firm and what you're up to these days?
Sure. We're a home fragrance company. So we make various products that help homes and cars and offices smell terrific. And we're grounded in products that have the disruptive potential within the category and that are highly authentic, which for us means born from the earth with pure fragrances. And probably the one product that we have in market today that is best known is a product called Scentsicles. For those of you, I don't know about you, John, whether you read the Sexiest Man Alive issue of People magazine or not, but
I may have looked through that in the grocery aisle. I don't think I've ever bought one, but
Well, we actually have a nationally advertised program behind Scentsicles, which was anchored this last year, just a month or two ago, with a 2-page spread of a lumberjack who was half naked, laying on a bear rug. Bellied up to a white artificial tree, unbelievably smelling the scent of a real tree from our product that was hanging as a decoration on that tree, the Scentsicle itself. And, of course, the headline for that ad was Afrotrigiac. And off in the bottom right-hand corner was a nice picture of our product and a scratch and sniff.
Okay.
So the lumberjack is our icon that speaks loudly about the purity and the authenticity of that fragrance. But the truth is, all of our products that we manufacture, we take pride in the extent to which they're just a real authentic reproduction of the truest scent possible.
So a Scentsicle is about a foot long stick that smells like a fir tree.
An artificial tree smell real.
Right.
Or a real tree smell better and longer.
Okay.
And, of course, we have various fragrances in the Scentsicle franchise, ranging from Douglas fir to blue spruce to white pine, which are the three most popular scents.
Okay.
But that's a real hit product for us. It's available in the United States at retailers that win in the Christmas category, which would include Walmart, Target, Bed Bath, Home Depot, Lowe's, Michael's, Joann's, BJ's, drug stores and grocery stores as well.
Now, this strikes me kind of like wheels on luggage. You know, it's this element of, well, why didn't anybody ever think of that before? How did this come to be?
Great question. And, you know, many of the best ideas around are the ones that seem the simplest. And many of those ideas aren't really simple at all when it comes to producing them at high quality repeatedly. And this product, our company was founded back in 2001.
Okay.
And our founder's vision was to bring real, authentic scent to public spaces. And he began to design and manufacture machines that would be used to propagate fragrance in hotels and specialty retailers. So, for example, Westin, when you walk into a Westin hotel, you may pick up on a very identifiable fragrance that is the Westin white tea and fig fragrance that exists at every Westin across the globe. And Jeff, our founder's vision and equipment, helped to propagate that across various climates and humidity levels and on a global basis, where Abercrombie & Fitch would be sort of the best-known specialty retailer that uses fragrance as a part of their brand equity. And so that was our business in the early days. And in 2005, Jeff received a call from the then CEO of FTD, who asked him, hey, you know, you seem to know a lot about fragrance. Can you figure out a way to make a real flower smell better? Because over the years, we've re-engineered flowers to look great for a longer period, but we haven't figured out the scent piece of that.
Okay, so you've solved this incredible mystery for me because, you know, you go out and buy flowers these days, and they don't smell like
that's
anything.
Right. So that's right.
This is actually a plot this to re-engineer re-engineer flowers. That's
it's
good to
genetic
know.
Mutation or something. Okay. I'm not sure.
Excellent. Mystery solved. Thank that's you, right. Nick. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's right. So Jeff being, you know, the mad scientist that he is, you know, Jeff used to be at NASA and has had a very entrepreneurial existence since then. And so he went off and tried to figure out a way to make a flower smell real longer and came up with the idea of our core product, which is the scent stick. And a scent stick is an all-natural fiber-based stick into which we infuse pure fragrance. And in the context of florals, we're able to infuse a really authentic rose fragrance into that stick, which is then placed inside of a vase. And lo and behold, for 2 or 3 weeks, you're able to smell the beautiful scent of a rose along with looking at a beautiful rose. And shortly thereafter, Jeff thought to himself, okay, well, I can make a rose smell better longer. I can certainly make an artificial tree smell real. And he came up with the idea of the scentsicle. And that was probably 06 or 07.
Okay.
And at that point, Jeff, again, had a commercial business with hotels and retailers and didn't really have much retail distribution in terms of resale, but started to work through gift stores to sell scent stems, which is the flower-based product, and scentsicles, which was the tree-based product. And scentsicles just seemed to take on a life of its own and then had a lot of traction early. And right about that time, Jeff sold the commercial business off to another company that was in that business already, which allowed him to focus on the scent stick and its executions for floral and for Christmas. And a lot of us came on, some of the newbies in 2009, and we managed to get distribution of that product at Walmart, which was our first retailer of any size and scale. And we kind of lucked into a test at Walmart of a display of 30 of these tubes of scentsicles, and we had stores that were selling out overnight. It was just sort of a crazy phenomenon that started. And
so it was really an immediate success once it got to the retail location.
That's right. Yeah.
Incredible. How did you get involved personally in the company?
Well, I've been in consumer products pretty much my whole career and had run a company called Evercare, which was a family business that we bought in a management buyout around 1997. And we ended up selling that business in 04. And as a part of that, we had some products that were fragrance related. In fact, we did some work with Procter & Gamble around the Febreze brand. And when I left Evercare, I started a company called Brandscape, and we became a licensee of the Febreze brand from Procter & Gamble and to launch a line of closet accessories that helped to make clothes smell fresh for an entire season. And those were branded Febreze. And I transitioned out of that business in 08. And the folks that currently own EnviroScent found me to help sort of look at the scent stick and evaluate its potential and as a part of their due diligence. And I really fell in love with the product. And fortunately, they invited me to come on board the company and help to lead it, which I did in 2009. So that was September of 2009.
So I know you've expanded the product range across the board. How do you go about this product development side of things? I would love to be a fly on the wall when you're coming out with a new fragrance or whatever, but talk about that creative process and then actually bringing it to into commercialization as a product, as a new product.
Really good question. You know, we like to think about product development in two buckets. There's a spectrum of mild to wild. And mild product development are things like fragrance changes, or we might alter the size of the scent stick, make it longer or shorter for a particular purpose. But then there's more.
But not really anything that's going to have an impact on your manufacturing process or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, yeah. Some of that okay. does, but not in a real meaty way. The wild product development is very different. And that's development where you're really trying to reinvent the way the world uses fragrance mm-hmm. in a disruptive way, or you're trying to fundamentally change the way the product performs. And the first kind, that mild kind, is just very sequential. It's very linear. Stage gate product development processes work really well for those things. You just need to stay on track, and you have deadlines and critical paths and so on, and things get launched on time, hopefully, and successfully. The wild part is where you can really create a lot of value if you do it right. And I had a mentor, an individual on our science council by the name of Pete Rodriguez, who spent his career at Procter & Gamble in their R&D organization. And I'm not sure if this is still true, but at least it was a few years ago. P&G actually employs more PhDs than any company on Earth.
Wow.
So they have a fairly robust science engine. And Pete once told me, you know, real innovation and real product development is not linear. It's much more like a pinball machine. And you oftentimes have to follow that pinball until you find a winner. And as a consequence, with that second bucket of innovation, the stuff that's a little bit more wild, you end up needing a team of people, some of whom are right-brained, some of whom are left-brained. You need process, you need stage gate, but you also need to have the willingness to take a step back and say no, go back to the drawing board with new learnings and start over again.
Can you bring us into some of the wild things you have on the drawing board, or is that top
secret? Sure, no. There's you know, I don't know how wild it's going to seem to you or anybody listening, but you know, our fragrance product, especially a passive fragrance product. The passive just means you don't have flames, or you don't have batteries that have fans. In other words, you don't have an energy source to propel fragrance.
In other words, they're safe to use.
Correct.
for people like
mine.
Me.
But you know, passive diffusers all suffer from a phenomenon where when you have fragrance on top of the fragrance form that's just sitting there as a liquid layer. For example, on a scent stick, you know, when we infuse fragrance inside that great natural form, there's a layer of fragrance that sits atop the stick. And what ultimately happens is that that fragrance diffuses very quickly and very intensely. And so over the first 3 or 4 days, you know, we get as a result a real hot experience, an intense experience. And then the fragrance form does its work. And in the case of ours, you know, we wick fragrance to the surface of the scent stick in a very linear way over the course of another month or so. But inevitably, you have this phenomenon where the first 5 days, you have this intense experience, and maybe you put fewer scent sticks out as a result because that's your fragrance appetite. You want 2 or 3. But then after day 5 or 6, you realize you may need a couple more. And the risk with that is that you're feeling disappointed that it's not performing at a level that you had come to expect over the first 5 days. So solving that problem is something that, truthfully, nobody's been able to do forever. And when I say nobody, it's the folks that are the big guys in the category, which include Procter and SC Johnson and Reckitt Benckiser and many others like them, despite significant effort along the way. And, you know, we have an R&D organization that's small. You know, we've got one PhD who is just a wicked, you know, smart A player named Bao Do, who, you know, is Georgia Tech and Emory and spent 10 years at Kimberly-Clark. And we back him up, and he's sort of a chemical engineer, analytical chemist. We backed him up with somebody who knows natural fibers very well, who's Eric Mennert. And they have one or two other folks that are scientists that work alongside them. But inevitably, what they found was that, you know, we have really a two-phased problem. And one phase was making sure that we modulated the release of the fragrance in the first 5 days so it wasn't too intense. But then the other phase was making sure that we had something pushing the fragrance out over the course of the back 30 days or so. And this was not an easy challenge, especially when we put the limit on them of having this be all natural,
right?
Because we have a very natural-based form. And so what they ultimately found, and this is obvious, you know, we fortunately have this patent pending globally, so I can share some of this with you, but what they found is that by using essentially a starch coating on the outside of the stick, that starch acts as a pace car. So it limits the extent to which the fragrance can diffuse. It says, okay, you can only go 55 miles an hour, let's say. And then we infuse, in addition, this to solve the second phase problem, we infuse a silica, which is a desiccant, into the stick itself. And if you bought electronics from overseas, you know those bags of desiccant that you come, that you get with those oftentimes to prevent moisture from accumulating inside that box. So we use a nano-silica infused in the stick. What does it do? Well, it absorbs water, or in the case of our product, water vapor. And that water vapor is hydrophobic, which means that it doesn't like fragrance, and fragrance doesn't like it, because fragrance is an oil, an essential oil. And so the water forces the fragrance out. This is all a very natural mechanism. We call it hold-push, or HP. So we hold the fragrance in for the first few days, and we push it out in the back few days. And as a result, we have a product that, with our first launch of HP, it's called AutoStix, and it's now available nationally at Target and soon at Walmart. And it basically is a very linear experience for a month or so, and it's just a beautiful thing. But the point that I want to get to is that, you know, this was a lot of trial and error.
Right.
And there's no book that said, hey, go do this and you'll solve the problem. It was, you know, trying 40 or 50 different things to try to make it work, and then realizing, well, I have a second problem, and that's pushing it out in the back half of the life of the product, and it needs a different solution, and all of a sudden, you know, how are these things going to, are they compatible, the solution for one, is it compatible with the solution for the other? And, you know, I very much was like a pinball machine. And so as a leader, you know, there's a choice that you make. You either accept that and encourage that and promote that and celebrate that, because there are failures along the way every day, or you say, no, we have a timeline. We got to hit it.
Right.
And the natural tendency is to want to do things faster, and timelines tend to take over processes like that. And as a consequence, you have suboptimized innovation.
Right.
And so just as a leader, my learning and the coaching that I've had along the way is that, you know, you have to know what to encourage and why, and recognize that things that are good typically take longer.
Well, and sometimes that those wild things are aha moments, but oftentimes, like you say, sometimes it's multiple month or year investments of time and research and the energy of your team. And That is fascinating. Congratulations. This
Thank
seems
like
really
it
could be
it.
Truly a revolutionary
game changer
for your industry. Love to come back to a couple of things that you brought up, but I want to get Robert into the conversation. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Tell us about Brookwood Associates. You have just last year celebrated your 25th anniversary, I believe. Congratulations on that. We admire your longevity. And tell us about your firm.
Sure. And to make a connection between Nick's story and what we do, we work to help the owners of businesses like Nick's business more effective in terms of achieving their strategic objectives, whether it's raising capital or maybe they need to buy out a partner, or maybe they want to make acquisitions, or maybe they want to ultimately exit. So the engine that really drives our business is private businesses. The way I got involved in the business was I'm a typical, you know, founder who worked for a big company in my industry and then saw a market niche and decided to go out and start my own business. I'd worked for larger investment banks for about 10 years in New York, and then recognized the opportunity to work with private businesses who weren't getting the same level of attention on these strategic financial matters that I thought they needed and deserved. So started the business here in Atlanta, I set up a platform, John, where hopefully we could attract people that were very experienced at the business at bigger firms who similarly wanted to have an entrepreneurial experience, and they wanted to have more control over their destinies, and they wanted to do the business without some of the bureaucracy and the other requirements of being part of a large organization, much like Atlantic Capital Bank,
right,
when you guys got started. It's,
sure,
it's kind of a similar phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
The result of that ultimately was attracting seven managing directors in Charlotte and Atlanta over the last 25 years. And today we have an organization of 25 professionals that are pursuing that business.
And so you're doing, in addition to traditional mergers and acquisitions advisory, all kinds of financial consulting as well. But you help both buyers and sellers, I guess, through that process. Is that correct?
Yes, John. It's the clients that that hire us to represent them on the buy side. In other words, they want to buy other businesses. Those tend to be foreign companies that might have significant assets in the U.S., but they don't have a corporate development officer or a CFO in the U.S. who can effectively execute an acquisition program. We have one company in Europe that's used us on 7 acquisitions in the U.S. And sometimes it's a U.S. corporate where their corporate development group is busy doing something else. And very rarely it's one of our private equity clients on the buy side.
Okay.
And then the other, we also provide fairness opinions for boards of directors that are facing very difficult situations. They've probably had to set up a special committee because there's a conflict situation that might involve a going private transaction or some other major event in the company that will have to go out to shareholder votes, and they want the support of a fairness opinion in making their decision.
And I guess what people are really hiring you for, or your partners in the business, is your expertise, and oftentimes that comes in the form of real industry expertise. What are some of the industries that your firm is particularly accomplished at?
John, when we started the business, we worked across all industries, and to some extent, there's a functional component to what we do, and people will hire us when we haven't necessarily done a transaction in their industry because of the size of the transaction and the focus of our senior people. So there, a year doesn't go by that we don't work in an industry that we've never worked in before. And having said that, our 7 managing directors have majors and minors. We have a component of our firm that works exclusively in the restaurant industry. We do some consumer and retail outside of restaurants. We do a lot of business services. We do a lot of good old Rust Belt manufacturing businesses. And then distribution. There's, being in the Southeast, there are a lot of distribution businesses, and so we've had a number of distribution clients over the years.
Has your decision to start and grow your business in Atlanta and Charlotte been a competitive advantage for you over the years? So often with mergers and acquisitions and, you know, kind of sexy investment banking stuff, people think about New York and London. But how have you found Atlanta and Charlotte to be as headquarters and areas to really attract great talent?
Well, it's reflected our market. Again, we were going after the privately owned businesses that were underserved by the New York investment banks when we got started.
Okay.
And so we wanted to be, obviously, these were we've got people that want to live in these cities, and these are much better cities to live in than New York, obviously.
Agreed.
Goes without saying. So it has been.
And it doesn't snow here like it does.
Well, that's right. That's right. In terms of attracting talent, John, Charlotte was really, because the Charlotte banks got very big way before, in fact, the Charlotte banks basically bought 2 out of the 3 large Atlanta banks.
Right.
There were more people who do what we do in Charlotte. So it has been a very good place for us to grow because there was a lot of talent in that market. And there's some great privately owned businesses in the Southeast.
Right.
And so it's a great place to be.
So, tell us a little bit about the market to sell your company these days. We've kind of gone through the 08 downturn and kind of come back up. What are the market conditions these days for business owners who might be interested in selling a portion of their business to grow even more, or prospectively to sell their 100% of their business?
John, just to take a bit of a historical perspective on that question, back in the, if you go back as far as, say, a 1980, and you had that private business owner who wanted to sell his business, he wasn't going to leave it with his children or have some other exit. He basically could find a corporation, a large corporate in their industry, who would buy it. You could go public, but unfortunately, there was a very tiny sliver of private companies that could go public, you know, less than 1% probably. Mm-hmm. Or he could sell it to his employees, and that wasn't a very attractive option because he would you know, he wouldn't get a high value, and then he would be exposed. They'd be paying him out over time, and then sometimes the company's defaulted, and he'd have to take the company back over. So what's different today, and why it's one of the reasons it's so great to be a private business owner today, is that 30 years later, you've got another guy sitting at the table who's got a $1 trillion checkbook, and that's the private equity market.
Right.
So literally in one generation, the market for privately owned businesses has changed dramatically. It's very liquid, and that's not only good for the business owners who can get liquidity if they want to exit, but it's also good for the economy because these private businesses, which really are the engine of growth in our economy, are being rejuvenated and made more efficient and more dynamic.
Well, and there's also this element of sometimes a individual business owner might hit a growth wall and get to a point in growing their business. Maybe it's $50 million of revenue or $250 million of revenue where they really need either outside capital or expertise to, you know, kind of continue the growth. And sometimes private equity firms can play an interesting role in that as well, I would think.
Yeah, they certainly can. And we often see the situation where a private business owner will get to a stage where he's starting to encounter management problems and market problems. The typical entrepreneur tries to, they're very hands-on, and they try to do everything themselves. And they get to a point where it's getting a little bit unwieldy because they can't, the organization has gotten so large that they can't run it effectively on their own. They really need to bring in management. And that's a mental leap that a lot of entrepreneurs can't make. And so they are better off selling the business to a PE fund who can bring in the management team to take it to the next level.
So as I know, one of the strengths of that you guys offer in the process is that you know personally and have done so much work over the years with some of these PE firms. But perhaps elaborate on that and some of the other unique differentiators that you know, you really feel Brookwood brings to the market, please.
We are probably half private equity in terms of the company, private equity owned. So half of our clients are owned by private equity funds, and half of our clients are owned by the entrepreneurs like the founder that Nick described. They're owned by the entrepreneurs or the families. And we like to say that we are bringing the senior level attention from the people who are our managing directors. And because we're in a lower overhead environment than the bigger firms might be able to do the assignment, but inevitably they're going to kick it to the junior people because a $50 million transaction or a $100 million transaction just doesn't move the meter for mm-hmm. the large financial institution. But because we are entrepreneurial and have a low overhead structure, we can economically work on transactions of that size with highly experienced people. So I think having the right people focus on that transaction, and because we are privately owned, we also don't have to close X number of deals by the end of the year. We can take the long-term view. This is an issue that, you know, a lot of public companies face, is it's, they've got to live quarter by quarter. And some of the big firms in our business, they've got, in order for the professionals to earn their bonuses, they've got to close X number of deals. We really take a long-term relationship view rather than a transactional view on that. And we've just decided, look, as a matter of not only personal integrity, but to build relationships, we're giving the advice that's in the best interests of the business owner, regardless of whether it leads to a transaction.
So I want to bring us all together now and kind of kick off our time. Thank you, Robert. Kick off our time. Nick used a couple of terms that I want to explore a little bit more. One was this concept, Robert, of mild versus wild product development. And I'd love your perspective on how wild development can have a impact on the valuation of a company. And then secondly, you use the word disruptive. And I want to talk about disruptive a little bit because we're in a really disruptive economy right now. And, you know, that's become a word that's been bandied about. But I'd love to kind of explore that with you. But mild versus wild, and how does that kind of help valuations?
All right. Nick, help me understand your definition of wild.
far from center, far from where the category or technology is at a point
mm-hmm.
in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously, when the valuation is very much driven by the competitive barriers in a business. And a lot of the middle market companies, privately owned businesses in America, don't have, you know, a technological edge, or they don't necessarily have patent protection on a lot of. They don't have a new molecule. They're not a biotech company that's got right. a new molecule. But to the extent that they can have that innovative product, it definitely drives much higher values.
Okay, and so prospective buyers, whether they be strategic or financial or otherwise, are willing to kind of buy the story and pay for it, potentially, it has been your experience.
Well, and they have a very easy way of testing that. If you say that something's special, that means that people will pay for it. So you don't have to go much farther than the gross margin of the business to understand whether consumers, whether they be industrial consumers or individual consumers, value it. And so if a company has been able to sustain high margins, then you know that they're doing something that's unique.
And that's oftentimes where this disruption concept comes in, because if you're disruptive, I guess you're by definition innovative. And so if there's with innovation, typically comes some margin. Has that been your experience, Nick?
Well, it's certainly the goal.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to disruption, you know, the iPhone is a great example of something that's reinvented 1,000 different categories, you know, from radio to healthcare now, et cetera. And for us, you know, there's home fragrance is a $7 billion business in the U.S., about $24 billion worldwide. And there are big players with franchises that have existed for a long time within that category. Think about plug-ins, think about candles, $4 billion worth of candles sold a year.
Those Christmas trees hanging from all those taxis.
My gosh, that's right.
We've got to get rid of all those.
We're on a mission to get rid of those right. Those little trees. You know, but so I guess the point I'm trying to get to is that all of existing problems have shortcomings. All of them do. You know, a candle has a flame. It's messy. It melts. It drips. A reed diffuser, which is 800 million or so of the 7 billion, can spill. It has oil. It damages furniture. It can pose a health hazard to kids or pets. And you can go on down the list. And for me, disruption solves those problems, even though if you ask a consumer what they like or dislike about their candle, they probably won't tell you exactly what's wrong with it. You know, it's not that obvious. It's just been around forever, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
So disruption is helping to address those unmet needs that often aren't even voiced to you in creative ways that are versatile and easy. And I'd like to think that our product does that, right? I mean, it's a cleaner way to fragrance. There's no wax. There's no spilling. It's greener. It comes from the earth as opposed to petroleum or plastics, et cetera. And it's pure. We use 100% pure fragrance oil. We don't dilute it with solvents or binders or chemistry that other form factors need to make them work. And so as a result, we just serve a lot of different purposes with one base product. Can't catch your house on fire. It's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna do any damage to your furniture, et cetera.
You've mentioned a couple times the whole green initiative within your company, and really, I guess part of it's driven by consumer demand. Robert, have you seen green elements be important to value creation in companies? And is that a trend that's continuing, or has it kind of plateaued?
The range of industries in which that is important is astonishing. I'm working right now on a situation with hospitals where you have medical devices and other waste that comes out of an operating room that is very expensive to package and to cart off because it's hazardous waste. And so there are companies that have innovated ways to reuse and re-sterilize some of the important components. And you find that if you talk to the people who are in the operating room and the nurses who are collecting all of the instruments after the procedure, they say the thing they like most about it is they get to put these devices and some other gear into that green bin which they know is going to be recycled, right, instead of the red bin, which is going to go off to the hazardous waste provider. So mm-hmm. even in healthcare, but we as a firm, we have tried to get more involved in that, John. I've been going to a conference out west for years now called Expo West, which is really a go-to conference for a lot of consumer products that are in the health and wellness category. And we've been spending a lot of time there, and basically anything that is sold in a Whole Foods or a vitamin shop that can, you know, increase your performance and health is very, very hot right now in our business.
And that seems to have become a cultural cornerstone of Envirosyn.
It is, you know, but I will say that, you know, consumers haven't yet made it clear that they're willing to vote with their wallet for natural product on a mainstream basis. Mm-hmm. And our point of view is that we may very well win the ties by doing the things the way that we do them with respect to, you know, respecting the earth and even the manufacturing footprint that we have. And, but long term, we believe that that's where the puck is going to be. And so we're skating there now. We just, you know, our DNA as a company, as leaders within the company, we believe that we have a responsibility back to the earth. And so we celebrate that every day in decision-making, recognizing that, you know, in certain parts of the world, it's very important to consumers, but in many parts of the world, it's not yet mm-hmm. important enough for them to vote with their wallet as far as consumer products go.
Right. Interesting. So you're in the great position where you're doing the right thing, and your products are viable from a commercial standpoint,
right,
as well.
For sure.
Yeah.
But you know, for example, with the HP technology that I mentioned a few minutes ago, could have very easily used chemistry that wasn't particularly friendly to the earth,
right,
or to people. But we, as part of our brief to the science team, has to be natural. And we ended up with something that we think is really terrific as a result. It took longer, but it's worth it.
Nick, I know that you have, in working with the founder and others, have built around you a great board. And so many private companies either have informal advisors or actually have gone to the effect of forming a board and all. Can you talk about just the importance and value to you as a leader and also to your institution of your board and how that's kind of had an effect on things?
Yeah,
because there's a lot of people out there that are struggling with this issue of, do I form a board or not? Is it more of a hassle than it's worth, et cetera? And then, Robert, I'd love your perspective on that too.
It's a great question. And I think there's a red herring out there related to, you know, boards of directors. And as a private company owner, I've a lot of friends that are in a position where they say, you know what, I really don't want that oversight. And then you have the fiduciary responsibility and board governance and all those issues to deal with. And that may be the case. There are ways to solve those problems, though. And then the benefit that you get by having really bright minds around the table is incredible. It's actually salient for me because we had a board meeting yesterday.
Oh, so. Okay.
we are private equity owned. So clearly we have a board that consists of a majority of those folks. We have five people on our true board of directors, and it's myself, our founder, and then three representatives from our private equity group, all of whom are operators. They've been in operating roles throughout their careers. So they don't bring the financial engineering mindset that many private equity groups do. And for me, at least, I really prefer those that bring an operating lens to the value add that they provide to one of their portfolio companies. And
so you're really getting assistance from them either on manufacturing process or margin issues, or potentially help picking up the phone for that next big company that might be,
you know, we use
product.
Our board, I think, a lot differently than most use their boards. And we are a very forward-leaning board. Before I leave, who is on our board? So we have the board of directors. But one thing that I will really commend them on is what they allowed me to do early on with respect to the board that we generally, that meets, because that consists of the board of directors and an advisory board. they function as really one and the same. So every board meeting, our five external industry advisors are there alongside us, and we're just very forward leaning. I mean, it's, you know, we spend, you know, the board meeting yesterday, it's the end of the year, we have our January board meeting. We probably spent 10 minutes of a 7-hour board meeting talking about last year. Now, it was a good year, so that helps. But
right.
You know, the truth is we lean forward into problems and try to solve big things. And so the advisors that we have brought on from industry, I'll just tell you who they are because it'll add a flavor for what I would think any leader, whether you're 100% owner of the business or not, would love to have around the table. So we have Alistair Dorward, who was the founding CEO of Method Home Products. If you know Method, it's you know, a $0 to $200 million growth story. Started around 2000, really done incredible things and have a global footprint. And Alistair was instrumental in helping make all that happen. Of Carl Rahn, who was, I think, a 26 or 27-year vet of Procter & Gamble, where he ended up as vice president of research and development over the home business for much of his career there. And as part of that stint, you know, he launched Febreze. He launched Swiffer. Those are two pretty good brands to have under your belt. But he definitely has sort of the category expertise that you'd love to have around the table. Rick Ruffalo, who has been with S.C. Johnson on the Glade franchise, who has been chief merchant at Crabtree and Evelyn, who's been with Yankee Candle. So again, that industry voice. Steve Berkey, who was the VP and general merchandise manager over the home business for Target for about a decade. And then our newest addition, who was her first meeting yesterday, is Lorianne Goldman, who was the longtime CEO of Spanx. Hmm. So she brings a fashion perspective to the table. So having that cadre of individual around the table four times a year as a complement to those that do have the fiduciary responsibility is an incredible asset. And yes, there is rigor that is required going into those meetings to make sure that you are prepped. But I maintain that if you're doing that as part of your standard operating cadence, in other words, reviewing your operations quarterly, you're doing all that already.
Right.
And if you're not, then I would submit maybe you should be.
Robert, I mean, that's an incredible all-star board. Obviously, a lot of private companies can't attract that level of attention, but your observations on the value of a board and perhaps how to create one.
John, we see it most often in our family-owned clients. We do a lot of work with family-owned businesses, multi-generational businesses that are considering various strategic and financial issues. And that's those are the situations that are particularly difficult to get the family over the hump of having a fiduciary board of directors. I think every consultant that advises family businesses says that's absolutely what you should do, and they can point to success story after success story of having developed an independent board and how much more successful those businesses have been. And frequently our clients in that sector can't quite get there. And so the concept, as Nick mentioned, of the advisory board, I think is a really good first step.
Mm-hmm.
So that we definitely advise that with our clients. And I would say that, you know, probably half have adopted that approach and half haven't. And I think as far as the composition, clearly in Nick's case, they've got people that are very industry focused. And I think, you know, clearly you want somebody that if in a private business, you know, maybe you have that retired executive from one of the big players in the industry. And then sometimes the operator wants a more functional view. You know, somebody's got more of a strategic or a financial perspective on how do I increase the value of the business over time.
Gotcha. Really great advice from both of you. You know, just a quick observation. I would say for us, the private companies that have some type of board, whether it's informal or formal, or have some kind of outside voice as it relates to either through YPO or other organizations like that, seem to be a little bit more vibrant than some of the other companies that we work with. And so it could be a very useful thing for your growth. I'm going to shift and just ask you both the best business advice that you've ever received.
This is going to sound trite, but it's hiring people who are smarter than you are.
Well, it sounds like you definitely have one, and the PhD who came up with the new wicking thing, that's pretty cool. That's excellent. Thank you, Nick. Robert, thoughts
John,
on that?
John, for us, it was the advice to go outside when there was definitely something that we weren't solving on our own, not to be shy about going outside. And we felt that we weren't making enough progress in sales and marketing at a point in the past. And we went to a professional services firm that was global that we admired and studied how they did it. And we got in touch with a consultant whom they had used. And so we hired a marketing consultant who really redid our whole sales and marketing function that made a significant change. So it's don't hesitate to get out there and use those experts.
Great. Excellent. Thank you for both of those. We're going to go into the speed round where I'm going to ask you just a couple quick questions. Nick, what did you want to be when you were growing up? Were you always into scent?
I wanted to be an entrepreneur like my dad.
Okay, fantastic. Robert?
Basketball player. Sorry, I didn't make it.
If you were to be on a basketball team, either pro or college, which one would you be on and what position would you play?
Well, I went to UNC and they didn't need me as the point guard, but that would have been a nice spot.
Okay. So you're good with the ball, huh?
Not good enough, no.
Not good enough. Okay. All right. What about organizations or charities that I know you both are very active in the community. What are some favorites there, Robert?
I mentioned one or two. One is SteerSmart, which you're familiar with, and my wife has presented to over 10,000 high school students and their parents about safe driving in an hour-long program, and I think she's done it in a dozen states already. So that's just something that is precious to all of us who are parents.
So all one word, SteerSmart.
SteerSmart, one okay. word. And then a Mercy Care, which used to be called St. Joseph's Mercy Care here locally, and they're providing health care and dental care to the poorest in our community and literally have vans that are going out at night under bridges to take care of homeless people. Mm. So it's a remarkable ministry.
Great. Thank you. Nick?
Well, with three kids under 10, 7, 5, and 3, I've come to really appreciate the mission of children's health care, and I'm pretty heavily involved with that organization. The more I learn, the more amazed I am at the work that they do there, and it's just such an asset to have in our community. You know, the quality of care and the patient differential, you know, you can send your child to, you know, one of the adult systems, or you can send them to Children's for everything. And there's just no comparison. When the more you learn, the more you understand that.
All three remarkable organizations. What about, quickly, favorite movie? Nick?
Caddyshack.
Caddyshack, yeah. Okay. All right.
Dating Robert. Myself.
It was a tie for me between Casablanca and Ben-Hur.
All right. Fantastic. Before we leave... tell our listeners how they can learn more about EnviroScent, Nick.
Well, you could either pick up the Sexiest Man Alive issue of People magazine or come to our website, and we're happy to send you a poster of a half-naked lumberjack to celebrate the authenticity of Scentsicles, which is EnviroScent.com.
Great. Thank you.
And Robert? John, we're at BrookwoodAssociates.com, and be happy to talk to anybody who would like to learn more about what we do.
Fantastic. Thank you both for being here in the studio with us today. I really appreciate it. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.